You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. I want to welcome most recently retired and former Central Queensland University President Emeritus Professor Helen Huntley to the program. How are you?
Oh, Lisa, I'm very well. Thank you for asking and thank you for the opportunity to have a chat.
Now, you have extensive background in education, and based on your experience, what do you think is the purpose of schooling?
Great question. I actually think that schooling has a number of major aims, but pretty much needs to prepare children and young people for, I think, meaningful, purposeful, and making a valuable contribution to their society and an engagement with their society. And obviously, along the way, we need to prepare them for the world of work. But I don't just think there's an occupational fulfillment goal there. I think there's also a personal fulfillment goal. So we're not just making widgets in schools and churning people out to be tradespeople and teachers and nurses and retail attendants. We need them to be able to do that, but we also need our children and young people to have those knowledge, skills and aptitudes so that they can enjoy their life and really engage in it fully and obviously contribute to it.
Mm. So in what significant ways has education changed in Australia, say from 30 years ago?
Look, Lisa, there's positive changes. So schooling is much more, certainly curriculum pedagogy is much more research informed, but that can be good and bad, because I think that in Australia there's been, and in relation to say one area is the teaching of reading, literacy learning, I think maybe the people who write the curriculum have jumped from research outcome to research outcome, and I think sort of moved away, and there's just been too much change. So as a result, I don't think our kids have had the basics, but they're getting back to make sure that the basics are there. Certainly over the last couple of decades, school just doesn't teach to the middle, which it used to, I think. So there's a lot more individualised curriculum. But I do think there's been some negative things have happened. The curriculum in Australia is just massively overcrowded, just massively. So there's so much in there that the academic nature of what we should teach kids in school, which has always been there, but there's more environmental, societal, health, especially mental health, so many more other areas of the curriculum where teachers need expertise and then they need to find time to teach it. But I think the big one is a positive is that education and schooling has a much higher profile now than it had 30 years ago. But in some ways that's been quite negative, because, and I'll give the specific example of NAPLAN testing, the numeracy and literacy in Australian schools. So I just think that high stakes testing, it was meant, the intent was amazing and fabulous. It was meant to be sort of a low-stakes, low-key little test that teachers would do with their classes to identify students who needed additional support, and therefore the government would collect that data and they would be able to provide extra funding for those kids in those schools. But as we expected, the media gets hold of it and it's pretty much league table. So, just a lot of negative... A negative perception of teaching and teachers because of what NAPLAN does and doesn't say, when I know that wasn't the intent. Mm.
And it doesn't do any favours to the children?
No, I just think there's so many. If you looked at the stats, I haven't looked at them recently, but so many parents have identified that their kids, because the schools and the teachers and the principals who are data-driven place such high importance on it, it's scaring a lot of kids. They're really fearful, and there's anecdotal evidence that, you know, if teachers, I don't know, but if teachers think kids aren't going to do well, then they don't have to, they sort of, they don't encourage them to stay away, but they don't encourage them to attend. So there's a really high percentage of, I know in my state, in Queensland, parents who just say, they send a letter and say, my kid's not doing NAPLAN. So you wonder how long it will be before there's no validity in the data that's gathered.
And it stigmatized children also. It separates them from each other. And that brings me to the next question, which is about inclusion. Do you believe schooling in Australia is inclusive of all children and young people, as well as we of adults?
Lisa, I think the intent is there. Schooling, education across all areas in Australia intends to be inclusive, but we fall short, and there remains areas of equity, inequity, especially in relation to the opportunities for children and young people to gain a good education. So we have geographic areas. We have Indigenous communities. We've got regional, rural and remote communities. We've got kids with differing abilities. And I know the intent is that each of those equity groups gets a high-quality education. But in a lot of areas, they don't, and that's resource-driven. So Australia is a huge, huge, huge country with really remote communities, really difficult to service in some areas of education. So although we try our best, absolutely there's pockets of inequity still.
Mm. So thinking about teacher education in higher education then, what do you think are the differences in challenges between regional and city universities?
Okay, so generally in all areas of tertiary education, you know, cybersecurity is a big problem for us. Academic integrity is becoming a huge problem for us. Just the pace of technological change. And therefore, at CQU, we really pride ourselves on our online learning capacity, and 50% of our students study online. So when it's a twofold problem. So when the technology changes and updates and upgrades, we need to make sure that our teaching staff are able to upgrade and update. But we also then have to make sure that our students can access it. And sometimes, 50% of our students are mature age, and sometimes our school leavers are really confident with the technology and they switch on pretty quickly, but we've got to really invest that extra time sometimes in our mature age learners. And just all universities, there's competition. So there's competition for bottoms on seats. Specifically in the regions, though, we still have that brain drain. And I don't blame young people leaving school. They've been to school all the years. Some of them do school of the air, some of them in really remote locations, tiny little schools. They want to go to the bright lights. They want to go to the metropolitan university. So we can't stop them, and we wouldn't want to stop them. But that is an issue of, trying to keep your best and brightest in the regions. I also think for regional universities such as CQU, the government doesn't understand enabling. That's the bridging the gap for mature age learners who haven't had an opportunity to finish school, but to get them to a capacity where they can engage effectively and satisfactorily in tertiary studies. So we find getting funding for those enabling courses in the end generally is fund them yourself because you know it's the right thing to do. It's just a lack of understanding, I think, of how regions work. Sometimes we have difficulty in attracting and retaining staff in regional and remote areas because they want to bring their families and, you know, it get back. It's like a 360. Then if they can't see that there's opportunities for their kids, it makes it a bit of a challenge. But the kicker for regional universities, such as the one I've worked in, is that we work in thin margins. So we have small class numbers especially in those specialised areas like engineering and allied health. But we need engineers and speech therapists and physiotherapists and podiatrists. We need them in the regions. And we know if we train them in the regions, most of them will stay. But then, you know, it's quite expensive when your numbers are small. So, yeah, just a few of the things that we deal with, but I think we manage to deal with them because, you know, our intent is to service our region, so we need to be there for them.
Mm. So just what about the challenges of the pandemic and the climate change? It has changed, or has it not changed, teachers' work in regional areas?
I think I'll just focus on school teachers. Absolutely changed their work because schooling, apart from school of the air, like that distance education for, I talked about remote kids on cattle stations and sheep stations, etc. Schooling has just always been face-to-face. So teachers haven't had to grapple with online resources, apart from maybe just something locally at the school to, you know, house their assessment or whatever. The teachers have really had to grapple with upskilling themselves in a distance and they pretty much had to do it overnight. I saw it with my own two daughters who are in high schools teaching and administering in high schools. It was pretty much let's learn online, and you know, you've got 5 minutes to learn yourself, and then you've got to teach the kids how to do it. So the pandemic has definitely shifted the skill set of teachers. But the other thing I hear is that the students haven't got as great a commitment post-pandemic to actually attending school as they had previously. It's seen as a bit of a choice now, because I think they think that the resources are online, so it's not as important to turn up to school every day. So different problems for, you know, different stakeholders in the process.
What do you think of that?
Look, it actually depends who you work for. At CQU, in tertiary institutions, we've always given our students a choice. And of course, there'll be students who have to, there'll be disciplines that have to have so much practical work or work where you, you know, delivering, you know, nurses do medication, handing out medication. So there's got to be residential schools or some practical sessions. But there'll be some of our courses, a lot of our courses, where you can do the whole course at a distance and only see your students online on Zoom. So I think it's very different in terms of what we can achieve, depending on the sector that you're in. But I know for school kids, the teachers really want them in the classroom. And I think it's different to tertiary education, to unis. What are they doing? Mm-hmm. Like they're only from 12 years to 17 years, what are they doing in the daytime if they're not at school? So I think there's a whole series of other problems that you scratch the surface if kids don't come to school.
Mm. There's been a lot of talk about the mental health of young people who don't access school. And I'm thinking of during the pandemic, I would have imagined that would have had some impact on kids.
Oh, undoubtedly. And look, it's easy to say in my day, you know, my parents, I'm sounding like my parents because that's what you used to say. In my day, we didn't have this and we didn't have that. I actually think there are so, I'm not saying our kids are weaker in some way than they were in the past, but there's so many more challenges. There's so many more threats, if I can use that word, to the mental health of our children and young people that we just, as adults, it's like adults reflecting back on our childhood, that we didn't experience. Yes, there was bullies, but you know, you dealt with the bully in the school ground. You didn't have to deal with the bully after hours online, hiding behind a keyboard. And I just think there's a lot of pressure on our young people. So, you know, the mental health. I think when you've got teachers and they really care about their students, you want them in your classes. You want them in pastoral care. You want them at school. So. Not keep an eye on them, but actually you can monitor them and offer them support. And if you can't see the kids, I think it's very hard to identify when they might need some extra support.
Mm. And what is the role of parents? How do teachers work with? I'm thinking about, I mean, that must be really challenging for teachers if they haven't got, if that is not part of, say, teacher education today.
Mm. One of the 30 odd reviews of teacher education that's happened in Australia over the last couple of decades, one of the things that was found was that, and they did a really massive survey of early career graduate teachers, and one of the things they said they felt really a bit nervous about and didn't learn enough about at uni, this was about 15 years ago, was how to deal with parents and the relationships and building relationships with parents and caregivers. So that's something that I know is now in the professional standards for our teacher education courses, and something that's taken a lot more seriously. But then unless you do role plays, or unless you're in your practical experience, it's all sort of theoretical. So there's still some things that you need to do that you're quite prepared for, but you hone those skills once you get into school. But I just see what happens with my daughters. They have pretty much now, parents and teachers haven't, I guess depending on the policy of the school, and certainly at high school, there's this open dialogue. So the parents get the teachers, and especially the form teacher, the pastoral care teachers, email address and phone number, and there's portals where you can send home information and messages and updates about, in fact, I think you have to send updates about your child's, their child's progress. So that certainly the access that each has to each other is there. That can be good and bad, can't it? Because, some parents will only back their kids and maybe not listen to what the teachers have to say, and vice versa. So, certainly the opportunities there, and I think both the parents and the teachers have to have sort of the right frame of mind about how they're going to interact with each other, only based on what's best for the children.
Mm. And just quickly, the social media, how are teachers supported with children and students and their use of social media? And I cannot imagine teachers have to become psychologists or counselors. Mm. But is there any kind of support for teachers who recognize that? I'm sure everyone recognizes there's a problem, but how are they supported in managing, I guess, social media?
Look, I think there's a little bit of work covered in teacher education courses, and I think there's a fair bit of now of professional development for practicing teachers, but I actually think it depends what the policy of the school is. So some schools now have banned mobile phones, some have done lots of different things. So number one, I think you have to learn what the policy of your educational institution is and then align with that. But I think there's more support for teachers in terms of recognising when kids are in trouble or how to reach out to them. But I just think, look, I'm a dinosaur. I'm 60 plus. So, and I don't like Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account. I've seen adults bully each other. And it seems that we have to be better than our next door neighbour, and a better garden, and a better life, and a better of everything. So I joke jokingly and have said for 20 years Facebook's evil. Please don't sue me, Mr. Facebook or Mrs. Facebook. But I just think that kids have too much access. Like apparently pornography is fairly easy to access, and our young men, young boys especially, their introduction to human relationships and sexuality is what they see on a porn website. That's disgraceful, and that can't be healthy for forming relationships into the future. So I'm not sure. I think the genie's out of the bottle. I think the platforms are there. What we have to do is parents and families and governments, societies need to work together to see how we can maximise the positive impact of social media but minimise the harm where we can. But I just leave you with that question with how things have changed. My dad, in April, my father will be 96 years old, so he's been around for a while. And Dad was pretty good at school but had to leave school to help out on the farm, which I guess lots of kids did back in the day. But Dad said that the kids who had some aptitude at school aspired to be one of two things in those days. One was a bank manager and one was a teacher, because they had such amazing reputations around the place as being fantastic occupations and people you could trust. I would say probably both. If we did something now, not quite the same, which is a bit sad. You asked the question about what's a high quality teacher. My whole career, I've been asked that a lot by and politicians and media outlets, and I refuse to answer a high quality teacher question. I prefer to talk about what is high quality teaching, because I think there's subtle but really important differences. For me, high quality teaching is teaching that gets outcomes for students, make sure that students get as many of the learning outcomes as their potential allows them to be. Teaching needs to align to curriculum. As I said, sometimes it's overcrowded and you feel like, there's too much to do. High quality teaching meets individual student needs. And I guess in the old days, people used to say, well, what makes a good teacher? And I would always say, as a young person, I always wanted to be a teacher from when I was about 8. You have to like kids. You have to love children. Mm. That's changed over time too. You don't have to like kids necessarily. You don't have to love them, certainly you shouldn't. But you have to be really interested in facilitating outcomes for those kids. You have to be interested in their life and their work and their capacities, so that the work that you do is meaningful for you as a teacher. And you have those light bulb moments. So I used to explain to I taught phys ed to aspiring teachers in the teacher education, amongst other things, because I was a phys ed teacher by background. And I said, phys ed teaching is really rewarding, because you can see straight away. You can't see that a child has grasped a maths concept until after a little while and they've done it and they've showed some working. But you can see immediately, you throw a ball to a child, if they can catch that ball and throw it back to you because of the effectiveness of your teaching. I just think that it's really important that our teachers have an interest in those learning outcomes and are really committed to seeing their students achieve them.
So it's about learning, isn't it?
Oh, and a demonstration of learning, absolutely. Yes. And applying that learning to everyday life, as I said right back at the first question that you asked me, and contributing, being able to meaningfully engage in your life and your work and, getting a sense of positive feedback about it.
And it's about being able to inspire children and even higher education or postgrad students.
Absolutely.
Yes, so it is all about learning, and it's about an educator or a teacher, whether it's in schools or whether it's higher education. I think it's about their own interest in learning as well. That will then motivate or inspire students to become curious. I think, something that we don't think about often is curiosity, the importance of being curious.
Yeah, absolutely. And it starts in early childhood. I was reading just in the state newspaper. I'm old, so I'm old fashioned, and I read a newspaper in my hands, made of paper. But there was talk of the newish Labor government, the federal Labor government here, thinking about the importance of sort of free early years learning. And I actually spoke to myself, there was no one else here, and said, well, what have I been saying for 100 years? Like, if we actually focused on a provision of some learning for parents as well. Like, I used to joke and people would say, what's your advice on parenting? Now, I'm not saying I'm a brilliant parent, but my response was always, over many years, always have a wet face washer, you know, a cloth in a bag to clean them up when you need to. But more importantly, read to your children. Read to them when they're in the womb. Read to them when they're a month old, a week old. Read to them until they're 15 and, you know, or early primary school and they can read back to you. But if we could actually get some really good, free early childhood education and some really dedicated work with parents so that they feel empowered to be able to start those, you know, early learning strategies, we wouldn't be looking at NAPLAN in year 9 and bemoaning that we're not as good as other countries. So, you know, maybe over time that will be something that will kick in, and I absolutely know that will make a difference.
I got some early childhood teachers and principals who are doing it's a leadership course, and challenge that they have is to work with the parents. These teachers are quite different than if you compare them with high school or secondary education.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the base is there, but that play-based curriculum. It's interesting because we've got 3 grandchildren, 2.5, just turned 4, and nearly 9 going on. That's our granddaughter, 9 going on 14. But it's so funny looking and engaging, and I've had a lot more time since retirement, but engaging with the littlies especially, Huey and Charlie, just in what you can do it was Charlie's birthday, so I gave him some presents, but we gave him some gift vouchers, and I went with him to the toy store to select the gifts, and I really sort of poked and prodded him towards some of the games that were really fun, but a bit educational. You had to roll the dice, you had to see what the number was, you had to count them. So it's just really, and I think as a person who's been an educator my whole life, that sort of stuff just comes naturally, but that's the sort of stuff that we need to make sure that every parent and grandparent knows about, because it's all that incidental learning that makes the other learning just less problematic. Mm. And good fun. Has to be fun.
Absolutely. Yes, it has to be fun. You know, it was really funny because one of these principals I spoke to in early childhood, she said to me, because she's very much into the outcomes and, you know, learning and together with everyone. But anyway, so I asked her, well, how do you know when children learn? And she looked at me and she goes, Lisa, for me, it is important. Yes, learning outcomes are important, but that's not what I'm worried about. I want to see the children happy.
Yes, absolutely.
And I thought, wow, you know. So that brings then to the question of how can universities attract high quality student teachers, and how do universities further support student teachers after they have graduated from teacher education programs?
Mm-hmm. So to attract the first part of your question, to attract high quality students into teaching, I think the reputation of your course is important. Of course, some people have no choice. So some of our teacher education students, if it wasn't for us offering an online course completely, and we, you know, they can go on their practicums, their professional experience, and we will supervise them at a distance and work with their schools at a distance, they wouldn't be able to do that course. So for some people, there's absolutely no option. But I think the reputation of your course is really important, and that includes, you know, I used to always talk about early, frequent and extended professional practice, like practicum in schools, so get them into schools really early. The course that I taught when I taught phys ed, by the third week of their first term, their first semester at uni, we were all in the pool teaching little kids to swim, and out in the pool teaching them ball skills, etc. So that really sparks the enthusiasm of the student teacher. You can't just hit them with a pile of theory in the first year and expect them to be excited about it. So that reputation, the relationship that you have with your school, so that you know, we support the schools and prepare the schools and monitor the students, don't just dump and run. So I think that, along with a really practical curriculum, as I said, attracts students. I don't know about, the government seems to think that if you get a very high OP and you're interested in maths and science, then you'll be a good teacher. And I do, don't get me wrong, you have to have high aptitude to be a great teacher. But I don't think you can just be a teacher on your marks alone. So anyway, we're getting off on another tangent. But in terms of supporting student teachers, we need to support them strongly throughout their course, which I hope we do. But also I think we can support them as alumni. So we offer our students no-cost PD and some low-cost PD and, you know, further study, even by providing professional development in schools, we're supporting our graduate teachers. So we'll often offer mentoring programs so that a lot of schools now will have someone attached. If they're, you know, the new teachers will have a mentor at the school. But you can't just say, yep, you're a mentor, here's your clipboard, off you go. The skills and knowledge. So I think actually, you know, providing those school opportunities and alumni opportunities will support our graduates.
What do you think of mature age students coming back to education?
Look, 50%, more than 50% of our teacher education students are mature age students. Now, just we'd be aware, Lisa, that that can be a person who's 21, doesn't need to say that they're 50. The oldest, this is hilarious, but the oldest teacher education student that I taught, she was 60 when she graduated, and she didn't drive Mack trucks across the country. She was a force of nature, forced to be reckoned with, a really good teacher, a great student. And she ended up teaching in stations, so in right out in remote cattle and sheep properties, and had a brilliant life. So anyway, I digressed. But they have a pile of life experience,
yes,
that
yes.
Our school leavers haven't got. But on the flip side, they often have really entrenched views about teachers and teaching that we need to sort of strip away and rebuild a little bit. But no, more power to them, because I think it's a fabulous profession, and we need right across that spectrum of ages and experience, and they just bring a different richness to to the school.
Yes, absolutely. So coming back a little bit about to the online or online teaching, but we also have now the challenge. I don't know, but I'm curious about finding out, what are your thoughts about artificial intelligence like ChatGPT and its impact on education?
Okay, so I'll be 100% honest. Because I've sort of oversaw the initial, CQ was one of the first institutions, everyone's caught up, of course, but to really, I think, take academic integrity seriously and start the, you know, getting the technology and working with our techie folk at uni to make sure we could detect and all the things I talked about before, PD for students, PD for staff. And it's draining, because it's a bit like that game of whack-a-mole. So you get rid of five unscrupulous websites in a day and 10 pop up. So it's just this constant whack-a-mole. And be really, really honest, when all the media came out about ChatGPT, my very first thought was, thank you, Lord, that I've retired, because here's something. From what I could see, I refused to go in and use it, just quietly. I know some of my colleagues have had to see what it's like. But I just thought, wow. So if you can, I read something in one of the tertiary education publications that said somebody, a university academic or a university manager, asked the ChatGPT to write a strategic plan for a particular type of university, and they probably did a better job than half the ones that are out there now. So, look, I just think, so number one, you can't ignore it. You can't just say, well, it's not going to worry us, because it will. I just think we keep doing what we're doing, and we can't expect that we're going to say, you know, nobody use it because it's bad. Well, we have to keep doing that. But there will be a certain percentage of students at all levels of schooling and education that will give it a crack. So I think what we would do, I'm sure that what we'll do at my university is what we've always done in trying to, it's a multi-pronged approach. So there's a prevention. So we try to, you know, block out as much as we can. But there's an education and remediation as well. So part of that remediation is really looking carefully at the assessment, the learning expectations of our students, and trying to minimise the chat GPT. So if I was a phys ed teacher, and this is what I used to do, it was all fun and games. But we had, when I had internal classes, face-to-face classes, a chunk of their assessment would be that they would have to teach each other. So I'd have a clipboard and I'd have the learning outcomes and I'd be ticking them off and looking at what I was meant to be looking for. You can't chat GPT that. So I think you can't do that for every assessment of every course, every subject, but where possible, make sure that we've got our educators skilled up so that they can get as authentic an assessment, you know, the skills and knowledge and aptitudes that the student's going to need post-graduation, but also that perhaps can't be replicated on these online cheat sites.
Yes. So do you believe, I mean, the technology is just advancing in such a way, it's just mind-blowing. You know, and another chat GPT will, an improved version will come, another one will, I just think it will be ongoing. And the challenges, like you said, is for education and educators to be aware of it and try not to, I think the worst thing to do is to ignore it or pretend as though it's not there, or to perhaps put a big, that we cannot use it, because once you, you know, if we say you can't use it, what will we do? Yeah. We want to try to use it.
Yeah. Well, and if some of those professions, I was reading something that was from maybe architecture or design or something, anyway, they were just saying, well, if you keep your students away from it, that's going to disadvantage them in the workplace, because in the workplace, we will be using it.
So absolutely.
I think you have to always look at that post-graduation skill set need and sort of go with it.
So do you believe that the advancement of technology will take over teachers' job?
Oh, if it does, then we deserve it to happen.
Oh, no.
No. So what I mean is if we try to automate everything and just be, just stand and deliver and lockstep and not have engaging teaching strategies and stuff that's really practical and sparks people's imagination and creativity, as we've already discussed. And yeah, we deserve that some chatbot takes over from us. But not while I've got breath left in me would I see our teachers, you know, behaving in that way. I think that we need to make sure that our teachers have the capacity to be able to identify and use the technology that's, you know, really great for their students. But I still think you need the warm body. And even if that warm body is at a distance, if it's some sort of online learning, I just don't think we'll ever, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, and I haven't watched enough futuristic movies, but I just don't think that we can ever get away from the warmth and the empathy and the relationship building that's so vital to create that link in the classroom.
Yes.
To hand that over to a machine.
That was a different way of looking at it. It's it's teachers' own fault if we, if everything will be automated, you know. But I certainly don't. Well, I mean, as long as I'm teaching, I certainly don't want to see it. And I like technology. I think technology is valuable, but it's how we use it. You know, it's like social media. You know, the chat GPT, I mean, the danger is that we start believing everything that you put in a question and you start believing the answers. I've tried it out, and some of the things that it comes out when I'm thinking, no, that's not how it is. You know?
And you know, isn't one of the I just think back to my really early days at I went to Teachers College long before it was called a university, Teachers Training College here in the late 1970s. And, you know, even way back then, one of the most important things that was sort of drilled into us was anyone, even in those days, anyone can teach a fact, but anyone can look up a fact. In the old days, we'd look up an encyclopedia. Now we'd look up Google. But what we need to teach, the most important fundamental of education, is teaching students how to learn, and so that they can pretty much teach themselves, if you know what I mean. So it's not a, it's about learning how to learn, so that you can then engage in any level of education, whether that's self-education or guided education. And I don't think that will ever, I just don't think that will ever go away out of curriculums. And I think that's where we've done the 360 loop back to our first part of our conversation about making sure that we allow students to be curious, and we don't beat that out of them. We actually want them to be searching and wanting to learn and wanting to find out, you know, how to find out the answers for the questions that they have. But the first step is they've got to have the questions.
Just final question, what is next for you now that you have retired?
That's a $64 million question. So I think a little bit less hectic life. I think after all those years in education, 41 or 42, and I think the pandemic was exhausting in learning institutions. I'm sure that's no surprise to you. I'm sure you felt that. And I just felt that it was time to step out, allow my amazing colleagues who've got fantastic skills to step up and just spend some more time. I've got both my parents, they're very elderly. I've got grandchildren, but a very patient husband who's I've probably neglected for quite a few years. But I don't think I'll ever, I've already signed up and paid for a course. So I'm going to, Sticky's motto is lifelong learning. So I've definitely valued and prove that. But I've always been on not-for-profit boards and just finished, not long ago, finished a three-year term at a great community-based board. So I do think that I really would like to continue to give back. So I think maybe some board contribution. I'm going to join the gym. I'm just going to do stuff that I haven't had an opportunity to do. I was actually, this is not relevant to our conversation, but I was looking for some exercise clothes today, and a lady at the sports shop, because I'm joining the gym, she sort of looked at me and I said, the last time I bought exercise clothing, it was Lycra, and we all had a big laugh about that. So bringing myself up to date with the gym fashion has been really interesting, but yeah, just a few more things for me and for my family, I think.
Okay. So is there anything from the conversation that we have had, or some of the question that in particular you are thinking, though, I just want to say something. I just want to add to that question, or something that's kind of has come up for you that is important to finish off the conversation?
Look, it's been amazing. Thank you for the opportunity to chat. It's been brilliant. I just think I'd like to finish with the continually stressing the importance of education at all levels, right from, as we said, in the womb, the reading, right through early childhood and schools and into tertiary education. But I wouldn't be a loyal regional citizen and educator if I didn't finish with, I think it's even more important that we provide opportunities, high quality opportunities for our regional, rural and remote learners, school leavers and mature age students, to get themselves, to skill themselves up, to be ready to engage meaningfully in a tertiary qualification, and then support them. And then it's a 360. They will then graduate as a teacher, an engineer, a nurse, a speech pathologist. And we've found with our research here that 85 to 90% of our graduates who do their studies in the region stay and work in the region. So I just think that's a lovely 360 to finish the conversation, but to also stress the importance of education at all levels to sustain, you know, our economy and our society, and certainly our regional towns.
Mm. It has been absolutely wonderful having you on the program. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been an absolute delight, and all the very best.
Thank you. And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet I Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.